Welcome to Don't Pass Me By with your host, Bob Wilson. That's me. We're in the Shake and Wake Radio Network. Today, we have two wonderful guests, Mr. Ivor Davis and Mr. Joseph Brutsman. They've given us such books as by Ivor as The Beatles and Me on Tour. Joseph Brutsman has given us Marlon and Greg by Bear Manor Media. These guys gave us part one already, and that was a fascinating listen. It was so good that we're now bringing you part two. So I hand it over to them. So grab your socks and hose and pull, and we go back to classic Hollywood. Gentlemen.
Hello there again, Joe. It's a delight to have you talk to you like this. We had a conversation the other day, which was, I found fascinating, and I know that millions of people will find it even more fascinating. And so let me kind of pick up where we left off to some extent, because when I look at the Marlon Brando life that you knew so well, that you were so close to, that you had sort of an intimate look at, it reminded me of a Shakespearean tragedy run horribly amok. I mean, this was Brett Marlon was Othello and King Lear and Macbeth all rolled into one. Now, Joe, why was Marlon such a tragic figure? And did you and your wife Avra see it that way as you lived through it?
I think that's a great way to see it. I thought often of that, especially after I had a lot of Shakespearean training in New York and I knew the plays well, and you could not really stop comparing Marlon's life to that in the later years. I thought about it so much as you saw in the book, Ivor, and I really think I think so much of it has to do with this young man becoming so famous in such an amazing way, in such a unique way, in such a way that I still say a lot of people never experience that kind of fame, even the famous. It was just unique, and it was of its time and of its moment, and all these things I talk about a lot in the book. And I think everything changed then too. As you know so well, I mean, you write about the Manson murders and the Beatles. You and I both love studying that era where everything changed, especially in America, but really around the world. Marlon became this figure when everything was going on, like a sexual revolution and all these things. Marriage changed in a sense, certainly in America. And I bring all that up because I think Marlon was really a creature of his moment, along with this crazy fame that none of us will understand but him. And it affected every bit of his life, from how he related to other people after a while, how he was a father, how he ran his family. He always wanted to do things differently. I don't think out of just pure rebellion, or even just people think Marlon was haphazard or lazy. Not really at all. He just wanted to be as different as people thought he was, I believe. Long way to say, I think that by the time all that hit with his children and all the horribleness there, I'm sure there were a lot of people who said, well, yeah, this probably is how things end up. As you know, in that book, I write a lot about Gregory Peck, of course. Half the book is about Greg in Marlon and Greg. And I look at just the 7 years difference between Peck and Brando. They both had a huge fame. But I really do believe that the era and the time of when Greg became a father and became, had a family and raised his children, I think that just along with, of course, the differences in fame and career and who the men were, I think the whole culture changed so much, and Marlon was part of that. In fact, he was part of the culture. But you're absolutely right. The tragedy was just something out of Shakespeare. Absolutely.
Well, indeed, and if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind going through, because many people don't remember or won't remember, or maybe they weren't even born at the time, because
Right.
his tragedy scarred life. And yet that's what's so fascinating about your book, because we have these two characters, Gregory Peck, who was impeccable in a way in his life, and Marlon Brando, who was a gigantic mess. So those two, I mean, how can you almost speak of them in the same sentence? And this was why I enjoyed reading it, because they were so very, very different. Surely they were, you know, how would they have anything in common? You knew them both, you worked with them both, and yet it was like chalk and cheese.
You know, that's why I, as I was saying before, I didn't plan on being in the book this much myself when I started writing it, or along with my wife, Abra, who was Marlon's assistant, and Tony Peck, who was my writing partner, and Greg's son. But there was no way to tell the stories between Greg and Marlon without myself, Tony, and Abra. And it's like I say on the cover, they were polar opposites. And I thought, you know, it just hit me one day, especially after they passed on, that people don't know how difficult a life like Gregory Peck's was in this sense. And I say in the book that I think Greg is far more interesting than people will ever want, ever know about, and including myself. And that's because he had this giant epic fame. And yet, by the end, I believe he's one of the few men of that level who just came out, I wouldn't say unscratched or just, you know, held to the highest esteem by everybody in the world, but pretty darn close, in the sense that Greg was really his own man, and yet he really went out, if you will, with such dignity and grace. I've talked to Bob Wilson about this a lot, because what I love about Bob, our host, is he's a huge Peck fan, and he knows so much about what I'm talking about. Greg was just singular in that way. Now, you have that. And then in the same day, usually I'd go drive down the road and deal with Marlon. And, of course, Brando is Brando. There's no real comparison. But when they were both gone, I thought, wow, you know, I think Greg in his own way was as interesting with his challenges, with his want to make sure everything was as dignified and above board as he could make it in a place, as you know, Ivor, you know the town. It's a very hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to go through that ringer all the way from the 40s up through, you know, the early aughts. And here you are, you are seen as just a beloved figure like Gregory Peck. Now, Marlon was beloved as well for such different reasons, I believe. And I did know, as I told you before, they knew each other. But I think by the time I met them, boy, they both seemed really done with each other. And I never really knew what the situation was. I believe there might have been an incident or something. I don't know, but I did know they knew each other pretty well in the 50s, in the 60s. As you know, there's a few pictures and there's things that show they clearly were in the same circles. But when I think of how they both smirked at each other, or at least to me about the other, I thought, I think I get it. I think when I talk about Marlon, Greg just shakes his head and thinks, what happened to this man? And when I would watch Marlon kind of shake his head and think of someone who is still so in charge and orderly and, you know, commanding as Greg, I think that just to Marlon was something so foreign. And that's why I wrote the book about both of them. Someone asked me, why didn't you write a book about each one of them? And I said, well, it wouldn't have been as interesting to me. I think there's many books about Marlon, and I've seen a lot of them. I'm in a couple of them. There's a few books about Greg, and I don't know if they capture who he was and what he was by the end. I do say in the book constantly, it frustrates me to see so many books about men like that that just stop once they hit 60. The books stop. Like, you know, we don't really care about these men anymore. They reach 60 or even earlier. They made these big giant hits. And you see books like that all the time about Hollywood legends. And I, you know, Greg and Marlon to me, of course, because that's when I met them in the 80s and worked with them in the 90s. That's when I saw and knew them. And that's what made me think so much about the kind of level of fame that is so rare that maybe only a few guys have this. And I certainly saw Marlon and Greg in kind of the same level at totally different places. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think,
it does. And what I'd like to do is take a moment, because, again, many people tuned in and listening to you don't know some of the incredible history, particularly of Marlon's life. Now, I know you said you came into the Marlon focus and he came into your focus in the 80s. But knowing what you know, I'm going to just run through, if I may. For example, 1963 was when I first met Brando, and I think I mentioned it was at the Santa Monica Courthouse, and he was in the midst of a true life soap opera. He was in the custody battle for their son, Christian. And I think I told you that I went to the courthouse in Santa Monica, and it got so fiery that after one session, they walked out, and Anna Cashvey, his wife, bashed Marlon, and Marlon kind of defended himself. So you've got these two, a couple behaving badly outside.
Yeah.
Now, the reason, and I was interested in the case, my London office was interested in the case, because I don't know if you know, I'm sure you do, that but somehow the feeling was that Anna Cashvey, this young actress, had conned Marlon into believing she was an exotic. Now, and we knew in London that Anna Cashvey was actually Joanne O'Callaghan. You know, her father was an Irishman, a traffic superintendent working on the Indian Railroad. Her mother was Welsh. Mm-hmm. And Marlon, again, I wondered if, in retrospect, did you ever know that, you know, that would Marlon feel that he'd been conned by Anna, and that he, you know, he'd been taken to the cleaners because he thought she was this exotic Asian creature, and she came from a British, Irish, Scottish stock. I mean, did you know anything about that? Did you learn about that?
Well, you know, that's interesting you said it. I knew that about her, and I had he didn't talk a lot about her, in as much as I always felt bad he had such a mistrust of women by the time I met him, and how understandable in a sad way. And yet, I don't want to pass judgment on any of these women, but he didn't have a lot of male friends when I met him. And when we would talk about such things, he didn't talk about his marriages as much, but I could tell he was so mistrustful of women. And of course, you know, I'm sure that's not an uncommon thing for certain film stars and, you know, people with that fame. Marlon was also, I think, so well known for, you know, as I say in the book, he really wanted to take care of everybody. He wasn't this, some people think he was, again, a laxed father, or he tried to reinvent the wheel too much on what that was. But what was clear, especially when he had money and fame and it seemed like he owned the world, he really wanted to take care of everybody. And people met Marlon, and I think, I'm sure you probably read, Ivor, or even could sense with Marlon, there was something about him where he was very trusting for years. And every time he thought he was past that, and he thought he was, you know, wiser you might know a chapter in the book where he felt betrayed by someone in the book. And I remember I had a very strange talk with him, because I said some things I thought I would never say to him, because he was depressed about, he felt someone had betrayed him. And I said, you know, I just find it amazing that you're such a survivor, because I don't think people with your kind of fame, and he liked to mock it, so I even called it like ridiculous fame. I said, you know, you were, I brought up Marilyn Monroe and even Elvis Presley. I said, there's people who they're not with us today, because I think they didn't know how to deal with such bizarre lives. And he did. He did, you know, and I say that because I think Anna, and I don't want to name other people, I think that he had such a lifetime of that type of thing. And people would know his, that what's fun, what I find so fascinating about that story is that it was probably famous, his tastes, just the kind of women he liked. You know, it was already legend that Marlon Brando would like this kind of woman or that kind of woman. And Anna, clearly, I didn't know her. I had met Christian, and I know he had so many troubles because that, as you saw firsthand right there, that was a real troubled marriage. And I'm sure Marlon, after a while, wondered at times why he, why and how he got into such things, just because he was, Marlon. And again, I think it was a time when he was, I go back to that time period when America was changing ideas about marriage and divorce and things like that. And, you know, he was kind of at that threshold between America still feeling you were supposed to have this family and do this and that and this and that. He was certainly raised that way, even though his family had their own troubles as well. But, wow, yeah, that's fascinating that you were there and saw that in the courthouse, because there's famous photos of her slapping him right there.
Well, that's right. And the terrible irony, which I didn't realize, was that, you know, we go to about 1990 and Marlon is back in the same courthouse, Santa Monica. But this time he's saying, I mean, his son, Christian, is on trial. It turns out for murder and manslaughter. And again, mm-hmm. we did touch upon it in our last conversation, Joe. But again, it's almost like an unbelievable chapter in his life. Can you once again tell us that? Because I remember what the judge said, and I'll say that because I don't want to jump ahead of your story. But in the Santa Monica court, I remember Christian Brando was on trial for murder, manslaughter. And can you once again give us that? Because it just boggles the mind. I mean, if you came up with a Hollywood script like that, people would say, come on, that's a bit far-fetched, Joe. Do me a reason.
Yeah, right. And people who might not know or recall, Christian was Marlon's son from Anna. And Marlon had other children with different women. And one was Cheyenne Brando from his Tahitian family with a woman named Tarita. And Cheyenne was this beautiful young girl. She had a boyfriend from Tahiti, Dag Drolet, and Dag's father was a prominent Tahitian judge. And they were visiting Marlon, as often the family kids did. And at different times, it wasn't always like the kids were there together. But at one visit, Christian was visiting while Cheyenne was there with her boyfriend. And people believe there were drugs and alcohol involved, and Christian did have a gun, and the gun went off in Marlon's den, his large library he had up in Mulholland, and Dag Drolet was dead. And that's, Marlon hired Avra, my wife then, or my girlfriend then, my fiance, to help with Cheyenne, because look how much was in front of him. He had to immediately deal with a huge court case, the police, everything that was going on there. Cheyenne was totally distraught, understandably so. Avra was to help her with therapies and all these things. And then here's Marlon. He's Marlon Brando in the middle of all this. And it was a huge epic thing, as we talked about before. It was on that level of L.A. trial that really is like the Mansons or O.J. Simpson. It was just a big, big thing. And you probably know more about the court case and all that happened there as I do. It seemed to me by the end they were kind of able to get Christian, I would say, a better deal through certain mistakes the police might have made. I guess Shapiro was pretty good about that, from what I recall.
Yes, he was. And you're right. And of course, as a refresher, a Christian who was, I think, 32 years of age at the time, got a six-year sentence on manslaughter and 4 years for aggravating circumstances for the use of a gun. And people thought, well, that's getting off pretty light. And of course, Dagg's family were not very happy about that. So in a way, Marlon's pleading for sympathy or whatever paid off. But then, because you and your wife ever knew Cheyenne, 1995, 5 years after the trial, tragedy again strikes Marlon. Cheyenne dies after several failed suicide attempts. I don't want to use the word top it, but you know what I mean. Can you imagine a father having to undergo these two tempestuous incidents, scenes in his life?
You know, that's what I just can't get over myself. I remember the morning Abra got off the phone and she said, Cheyenne hung herself. Marlon was really so happy to get her back to Tahiti. He didn't want her in LA. And when she got back to Tahiti with her mother, Cheyenne herself was a mother, but she was still very upset about so many things, obviously, of course. Cheyenne had troubles even before the murder. She had been in a car accident. She had certain problems even before then. But with all this, it was really finally the last straw. I just can't imagine how Marlon dealt with it. I mean, you'd see Marlon. We'd go for long periods of time, at least I would, without seeing him at that time, because you just didn't know how much space and time you're supposed to give someone like that. And you just, you know, the fact that that's what I really meant. He's such a survivor. How he survived such things, I don't know how anyone would or could. I wrote a film where he played a prison warden, Free Money, and we shot it around 98, 99. We were in a prison in Montreal, and he and I were just walking through the cells. It was an old kind of closed prison we used for a set. And he was in costume and character, and we walked along these cells. And he said, I didn't know, I knew what was on his mind. We're looking at the cells, and he said, can you imagine being stuck in one of these places? And I didn't even have the words, because I was up at the house a few times after Christian was in jail, and Christian would call every once in a while. And I'd always leave the room, of course, when he got a call from Christian from prison. So that was one thing. The chapter that you talk about here, Ivor, I don't know how a man survives such a thing. Marlon was just, you know, he had years of thinking about so many things. He had years of even therapy where I think he was always trying to figure out the motivations of people, why they did it. It doesn't mean you're going to have any understanding of something as tragic as that. But that's when Cheyenne died, that to me was just really so tragic. I just, as I said, how he came through on the other end of that, I don't know. But
yeah, I mean,
he was an amazing guy.
Yeah. As a, you know, if you're a parent, you wonder that's what, you know, roils your brain. How did he do it?
Yeah.
So let's move to something slightly different, because again, reading and listening to you, Marlon and his fellow actors. Now, let me ask you first of all about, and you talk about it, Brando and Frank Sinatra, guys and dolls, an odd couple there, but you write about why they didn't get along.
Yeah, I guess there's so much has been written about that. And I think that people just did not want to see Marlon Brando in a musical, for starters, in this sense. That was the biggest play at the time. And here's the thing about it. Think about what Broadway was at the time. Broadway was very different then. And I mention it because, of course, Marlon came off of Broadway from Streetcar years before. One of the biggest plays ever was Tea House of the August Moon, and Marlon Brando gets to do it, even though whether he's miscast or whatever. Marlon kind of got to pick whatever he wanted to do. Guys and Dolls was bigger than Tea House of the August Moon as a New York play. He wanted to do it. Frank Sinatra wanted that part as well. But really the consensus, what's funny, someone was telling me just a few weeks ago, I was talking to someone in Los Angeles, and I'd read things, but they were telling me something I really thought, of course it's true. They said, you know who was madder than Frank Sinatra about Guys and Dolls? Gene Kelly. Gene Kelly said there is no one better in that part in the world, Sky Masterson, than Gene Kelly. When you think about it, if you know the play and you know the part, you'd think, oh my God, that's true. At least that's the way I think. I hadn't even thought of that for years. And I think Marlon's wonderful in the movie. And let's face it, that movie is fascinating today because it's Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra together. And I know I'm jumping around here, but it's funny you caught me at a moment when I was thinking of this Gene Kelly conversation, because I thought, man, that is so true. Gene Kelly in that part, that must have just, I heard that Gene Kelly never got over that. And Sinatra wanted that part then as well, of course. So Marlon Brando, here he is, you know, not known as a singer or a dancer in any way. I guess it was Sam Goldwyn or someone who said, this will be fascinating. And Gene Simmons herself, she was, you know, she was a classical actress. No one really thought of her, I think, as musical theater material as well. But that's the fascinating thing of that movie. Frank, and I don't think that Sinatra and Marlon knew each other really well or even at all before that film. And they showed up, and as you know, I think probably better than I do, Sinatra had that strange career that would always go up and down and up and down. And one day Frank Sinatra's kind of done. The next day he's getting an Oscar. The next day we're done with Sinatra. The next day he's got a whole new career with the Rat Pack. I mean, he talk about a strange, interesting, erratic career. I think one of the few people to really first criticize Brando when he came to town was Frank Sinatra. He was famous for calling him Mumbles. And, you know, you think of how, I don't know why people thought they might have got along, probably because they were both so unique and different and eccentric in their own ways. But clearly they didn't. And Marlon never stopped talking about how he, if I knew the story firsthand there, sitting on that set, I would think Marlon might have made an attempt to get along with Sinatra. There were certain people he loved and he never expected to, like David Niven. He did a bedtime story with David Niven, and he just loved David Niven. He didn't expect it at all. They became lifelong friends, and David Niven's very different than Frank Sinatra, to be sure. But I don't I kind of myself pin it on Sinatra. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe it's because I love Marlon. But Frank's a very tough customer, I would think. But I got to give him points. He loved and almost worshipped Gregory Peck, so I'll give him that. And I say worshipped in the best way. Frank clearly looked up to Greg. And you could see it every time they were together. You know, I witnessed that firsthand a few times. And I thought, wow. You know, and I mean, I only saw Frank when he was in Greg's house. So it's Greg's house. It's not like I was in Palm Springs with the Pecks. But when I saw it, boy, Greg was the man in charge and Frank was his guest. And you know, so I don't know. I looking back, when you think about it, it's amazing to think that Sinatra and Brando even got along even for a second enough to get a take done. You know, they're just too different.
Well, the interesting thing, I think that's a great way of putting it. The interesting thing, Joe, is that when I was covering Hollywood and the environment for my London newspaper and also for a magazine called Los Angeles Magazine, we knew that Marlon was a kind of almost, no, he wasn't a roommate, but they lived on the same territory. They lived next door. on Mulholland. And I wondered, again, two very, very different characters. To your way of seeing it and what you saw and witnessed, was Marlon and Jack Nicholson, and then they were on a movie called Missouri Breaks, and they go along very well on that. I knew the guy who was the set designer, and he told me some wonderful stories that I'll share with you at another later date. But I wondered, from your observation, Joe, Marlon and Brando were neighbors, very close neighbors. Did they hang out together? What was their relationship?
You know, what I saw from the late 80s, 90s, I'd never really saw Jack over there at the house or vice versa. I don't know where and how that relationship ended up. It's a great question, Ivor, because Missouri Breaks, I would love to hear your story, because I've heard different stories and things about that. And I knew Elliot Kastner, who put the film together. My friend Ed Begley Jr. ran up there to, he wanted to be a small part in it. And I knew Harry Dean Stanton and some others within the film. But there was something, I don't know where Marlon kind of, if he kind of crossed the Rubicon with Nicholson or not. I know that after a while, they weren't unfriendly as much as they just didn't, they didn't seem to talk. They would talk if something was going on about the properties, or if they needed to do something about the the mailbox or something that was, certainly mutual. Marlon just didn't talk a lot about him, and I sometimes sense that when Jack was huge, and he was, when I came to L.A., Nicholson was as big as anything got. And by the time he was getting that Batman money, I think people looked at Nicholson like, oh my God, this is like the richest man in the world. And he certainly was for a while. There was a time when that Jack Nicholson was the biggest thing on earth. Yeah. And sometimes I wondered if that's where Marlon got off the boat. I don't know why. Not that he was petty in any way. I think, though, when he saw people become huge, and he knew Jack before that. I mean, he knew Jack. Look, by the time Nicholson moved up there, Jack was pretty big, no doubt about it. But I don't think anyone could have realized how big Jack Nicholson could have got. And certainly to me, or to many people, on an even keel level and playing field as Marlon Brando, I would say, wouldn't you think?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, again, when I was covering, I remember there was Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson shared women, beautiful women. And I'm not sure they shared women, beautiful women with Marlon. I don't know. But while we're talking about odd couples, you in the book write about probably the most amazing friendship, Marlon Brando and Michael Jackson. My God, what happened?
Well, I think, I write a lot there about Michael because Greg was also friends with him. And when I talk about the whole history of Michael, obviously some of it are things that people don't always discuss because I obviously Michael has been through this whole kind of history where today things get reevaluated about Michael Jackson. But back then, Michael clearly wanted to, he really wanted to meet and greet and dine with movie stars once he was the biggest thing on earth. And he clearly did. And I remember when Marlon's son started working for Marlon as a bodyguard. And I think it was, I believe somehow that was an entree that Michael knew was a way to meeting Marlon Brando, because Michael by then was friends with, as you recall, Elizabeth Taylor and Katharine Hepburn. And I think Michael, once he was huge, he really extended his hand to so many of the old guard in Hollywood. And who doesn't want to meet Michael Jackson at that time? He was just epic. He crossed every line in the world. And by that, I mean, if you were young or old or rich or poor or wherever or however you were, Michael Jackson was obviously we all kind of, he was the soundtrack of our lives for a long time. And I don't think Marlon initially first thought about meeting him. I think Greg told me he had met him when he was young, back in the old Jackson 5 days. But then, of course, he had a very strong friendship with him later in life. Marlon, I believe, as I talk about in the book, I think Marlon was fascinated by someone like Michael. And when Michael hired Marlon's son, again, there was a meeting then that took place, and Marlon met Michael. And Michael was clearly, like I think most creative people, really fascinated by Marlon Brando, of course. And they shared a lot of information and secrets with one another, and in a way that people often do with Marlon. I talk about in the book, Marlon was the strangest thing with Marlon. He always liked people to tell him secrets. He was kind of like a Pope confessor. And strangely enough, once you knew Marlon, you kind of got sucked into this thing of telling him things you didn't know if you should tell him. I have no idea why and how, but he was Marlon Brando. He was interested. If he's interested in you, and he wants to know certain different things. And again, I bring it up because Michael was clearly really in love with Marlon. He saw him as a father figure. And when I think about it, it kind of made sense. I end that chapter when I talk about Greg and Marlon both knowing and liking Michael, in that I think I get back to that whole thing of that epic kind of fame. You know, I think that only a few people understand that or what that life is about. And I believe, you know, I will never know Marlon and Greg the way Michael Jackson did. Because he understands what that world is, that strange, odd world of just kind of giving yourself to the public and knowing that every place, everywhere you go and everything you do is judged in different ways. So it was a fascinating friendship they had, that's to be sure.
Oh, absolutely, because many people wouldn't believe those two would have much in common. But let me just change direction slightly for another wonderful story you tell in your book. And I'll preface it by saying that Marlon made a lot of money in his career. I remember reading that he'd made like $14 million for 12 days' work on the movie Dry White Season, which is not one of the movies that you can actually compare to The Godfather or any of them on the waterfront. And of course, he made such a lot of money on Superman. Now, and yet, there is an incident you describe very funny in the book when you and your wife were asked to play detectives in the Mission Impossible, which got you all the way to Tahiti, but it didn't quite work out as you thought it would be. Can you tell us about that?
I still have a hard time believing it happened, but it happened just as I wrote. Abra came home one day and said, we're going to Tahiti. And this is a time when Marlon, he could have gone, but it was questionable. It was after all the incidents, of course. And it was a time no one really knew if the Drolet family was still very much not wanting Marlon to come to Tahiti. He still had Marlon still had his family there, of course. But long story short, Marlon had these islands, and there was a guy giving tours of Marlon Brando's islands. He was, you know, making money. And it goes right to your point. I mean, is Marlon really that worried about what, you know, few dollars this man is making? But, you know, I think more to the point, and correctly, this man was giving tours of Marlon's island without his permission. And Marlon just didn't like the idea of it. So Marlon had an idea. He always, as you see throughout the book, he loves schemes and he loved tricks and he loved getting the drop on people. You know, he wished he could be invisible so he could be in rooms and hear people talking about him. You know, that was always his biggest dream, he said. But he sent us to Tahiti because he wanted us to videotape, asking that if I could just pretend to be like a tourism expert, and I was going to make this man agree on camera that he would, you know, expand his operation of giving tours to Marlin's Island. He was just one man with a boat taking a few people out there for a few dollars. And Marlin came up with his whole idea. He had a name and everything, wanted me to play this tourism expert from Quebec who would meet this man and ask if I could finance a larger operation to tour Marlin's Islands, you know, and we'll just, you know, that dumb old Brando, he'll never know. And that was really the scheme Marlin had for him. He already sent some people out there to try it, and it didn't work because, as I say in the book, it's hard. It's hard to stand there with a video camera and talk to someone who barely speaks English and go into some scheme and play, essentially written by Marlin, about how we're going to expand the tourism of his small islands. Anyway, we went there. Aubrey was working for Marlin at the time. It wasn't like there was a choice, I felt. We were out there. We do this thing. I actually had to confront the man, and I tried. I had to stay with Marlin's script. I was this man, Carl Dodge from Quebec. I run tourism from here to Fiji to London, and I would really like to expand your operation here. And I don't know if I got the guy to agree or not. I think he was so confused. And long way to say, Marlin was always, you know, he came up with this whole idea of getting the drop on this guy. And it really didn't happen. I do think by the time I got back and showed him a tape of how people were kind of leaving trash on these islands and all that type of thing, I think he was able to get kind of a cease and desist, I believe, years later for this man. But at the time, for Marlin to go to all this trouble, effort, and expense, that was amazing when you think about it. And you put it so precisely there, Ivor. I didn't even think of it, how you have all this money. Is it really, you're going to spend all this money now to try to get some kind of little almost con to work by sending people to Tahiti to frame them into this plot? That was pure Marlin. He always had an idea. He always had a scheme. He would, you know, I would call him Ralph Cramden, you know, the Jackie Gleason's Honeymooner character, who always had this idea and a scheme. And, you know, really, I think it boils down to this. I think Marlin so wanted to retire. I think he, as much as he liked acting, because he was always acting all the time, he would do characters for you right in front of you. I think he just, as we know, he wanted to retire. And I think he always felt there were too many demands, or too much family, too many properties, too many things that by the 90s, particularly, he still needed to pay for. He still needed to finance. And, you know, he came to me with all kinds of different plots and plans and ideas of how to make money without doing movies. And then he told Larry King, he said, I would like to stop doing movies, but I really can't. It's how I make money. And of course, that's why he thought he could make acting tapes.
Sure. Oh, well, that's another great story, which I hope you will pursue at some stage. And you and I have conversed about it. I just have one more question before Bob gets a chance to say something. You don't often get a chance to see Marlin talking frankly, amusingly, diggingly, but I remember watching the Connie Chung interview that he did. He was 65 at the time, I think, you know, towards the end of his career. He says to her, "I made some real dogs and I did it just for the money." I mean, he wasn't deluding himself. So I wondered whether, I don't know if you ever saw that, but if you saw that interview and Avra saw that interview, it sounded like it was the same. It was the kind of playful, kidding, rude, not obnoxious, but funny Marlin. Was that the character that you knew?
Exactly. And I met him right around that time. Avra had known him for years before, but I watched that so many times because I was just meeting him at the time after years of not wanting to meet him. I just thought I'll be too nervous, or I don't need to know Marlon Brando. I whatever. I did not want to meet him for a long time because he was Brando, and I didn't think I'd be a good company, if you will. But he finally forced that hand because Avra worked for him, and it was right around that time that he did that. And it was so typical of him because he really, you know, what happened, if you recall, even she is very confused in her introduction to the interview. Because really what happened, he saw a cut of Dry White Season. He hadn't done a film for a long time. He didn't like it, and he didn't know how to go about it. He was just angry about it. He was angry, and no one knew why, because the film was actually got pretty good reviews. And but you know, with Marlon, you don't know. You might have cut the wrong scene, and there he is. He calls Connie Chun, and knowing Marlon, I think he probably used to watch Connie Chun on television, and he was quite enchanted by her. He found her quite attractive, I believe, and that's why he called her. And next thing you know, he's having this conversation on CBS about kind of about Dry White Season, but not really. He couldn't, if you recall, he couldn't really put his finger on what he didn't like about the film or why he was doing that. And it was really, he just seen I think his first viewing of Dry White Season, and he was not happy about it. And boy, as you know, back then you really had to be careful because he could do a whole search and destroy on your film if he didn't like it.
Absolutely. Well, look, I don't want to cut you short, but our genial host Bob has we've left him at least 10 minutes. Bob, please take over because last time we don't want you to run out of time. So. With no further ado, back to you, Bob.
Well, this has been fascinating, so here's what I tell you. We have 8 minutes to the 3 o'clock hour, so we'd like to leave a little time for the station to do their promotions. So why don't you guys take the next 8 minutes, just mention your books, and I'll let you finish up because you've done so splendidly so far, and allow me the pleasure of listening to you guys speak out the last 8 minutes, ask yourselves whatever you like. Just please watch the clock and cut it at 3, and please plug your books. So, guys, take it away.
Well, I want to plug Ivor's books. I've been reading again The Beatles and Me because I was working with Bob Wilson the other day. He had been working on a Beatles book, and I said, I'm going to read this again because, I mean, you've written really the best book I've ever read about the Beatles, and you don't need me to say that. But here you were on tour with them. I have so many questions for you, sir. I mean, you're the journalist, so you quickly turn the table and start asking me questions. But the last time we spoke, I just was fascinated because I don't, you know, you've heard me say the Beatles to me are the miracles of Earth. I only believe in miracles on Earth because of the Beatles. And to speak to someone who knows them so well, I don't even know where to start. I guess I love at the end. Anyway, I've just got to say, people have to read this book, The Beatles and Me. Ivor went on tour with the Beatles, and then you kept up with them. They are still within your circle. They are friends of yours and vice versa. I don't know what to say because I'm almost intimidated thinking of I mean, I feel like being in the room with Gregory Peck or Marlon Brando is nothing next to hanging out with the Beatles. What was your first thought when you were a young man saying you're going to go on tour with the Beatles?
Well, I just looked at Ed Sullivan's show and I thought, hey, that's kind of an interesting gig. And I went on tour and I had a terrific time at a period when there was no security. I mean, we had next door a room. They had a suite. I had a room. I'd wander in there, I'd play their mini bar, I'd play Monopoly with John at 2 in the morning. It was amazing. And then, look, it's not until time goes by that you suddenly realize, hey, you know, that was an interesting time. When you're living in the moment, you know, you go through it and you observe, as you have done so well in your book, but you don't sit right down and write yourself a letter, do you? About
yeah,
it takes time to regurgitate, but But what I wanted to say was why I've enjoyed your book and why I'm enjoying talking to you. It's because I'm also doing, it's great, I'm doing a book about my adventures in Hollywood, a bit like you, but you know, I've got a few other people that I interviewed and got to know. And what this has done and what this will do for people reading your book, Joe, is that it will reignite their interest in Gregory Peck, the Gentleman of Hollywood, and Marlon Brando, the rebel without a cause, although that was James Dean, wasn't it? So, and you want to learn more. And I think you will, as I say, reignite the interest in both those gentlemen, very different gentlemen, couldn't be more different gentlemen, but fascinating parts of the Hollywood folklore.
Well, thank you, sir. I mean, coming from you, I'm just, it's an honor that you read it, let alone that I get to talk to you. I just love the fact, since we've been talking, how much you know so much more about so many of these areas and places than I do. Again, I was a film nut back when I was younger, and I came to Hollywood by the time people like Greg and Marlon were really in their last years, but you really were there back when things were happening with so many of these people. And also, please let me mention your other book, if it's okay. I know you have many other books, but the other one I've been reading is Manson Exposed, because you really cracked the case. You literally almost single-handedly cracked the case, at least sketched out the events for Vincent Bugliosi about the Manson murders. And it's funny, I often thought when I was up there at Mulholland with Marlon, what that must have been like for people like Greg and Marlon during that time. I mean, they must have just wanted to get the hell out of town, wouldn't you say?
They all wanted to get out of town. They all wanted to get out of town. And I think it was that very funny screenwriter that you mentioned before, Buck Henry, who said, because every movie star, including Steve McQueen, said, well, on the night of the Manson murders, I was due to go to Sharon Tate's house. And Buck Henry, I think it was Buck Henry, made a very funny remark along the lines of, well, if every movie star, including Steve McQueen, had gone to Sharon Tate's house, then there would be no Hollywood actors left. For some reason, Hollywood actors wanted to be associated with, we nearly got our comeuppance, but thank God we didn't go to Sharon's party. But again,
I just remind you guys one second, we have 2 minutes left, so I leave it up to you to close us out.
Okay. Well, that's the thing. Did you, by the way, I don't know if you saw the I think it was Quentin Tarantino's last film about Hollywood, and of course,
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, yes.
What did you make of that, sir? I mean, okay. You are the
very
Manson.
Quickly. I love the movie. I spent time at the Spahn Movie Ranch. I met the girls. They were eerie. They were Village of the Damned young people. It was scary at the time, and then when I saw Quentin Tarantino's movie, it reminded me how weird it was. And that's one of the great things. Of course, the film is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and the film is a fairy story ending. So, but it was interesting to see, and I must say, what did you think of it?
Well, I loved it, you know, and again, I liked the way what he does now. You know, he'll go to whether it's Nazi Germany or the Old West, and there he will be doing a Tarantino film with his own fiction attached to those areas. And then he takes on the Manson story, and I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. But I knew, of course, as you say, he had a fairy tale version of it. But I've been thinking about it a lot lately as I'm reading your book, of course.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, and I hope to see you one day, whether you're in Ohio, Los Angeles, or in the wilds of Montana.
Well, we'll talk again. I know that, because I really enjoy our conversations. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. This has been Don't Pass Me By with two of my favorite guests, Ivor Davis and Joseph Rutzman. It's been an honor to listen and have you on this show. We hope you guys will come back again, and you guys have made this one a classic. We'll see you again next week. on Don't Pass Me By on the Shake and Wake Radio Network.